There are fewer than 30 men in the world qualified to drive Formula One. A mere half dozen, perhaps, to win. At this moment, I'm inclined to think you're not one of them.
No, you want to.
Keep up the good work, and there you have it. There you go. With the qualifying.
Welcome to F1Weekly.com. My name is Clark Rogers. I'm the host of the program. I'll be joined by Nasser Hamid, my co-host. This is podcast number 1079, January 23rd, 2025. Nasser is on vacation this week, ladies and gentlemen. Yes, he does deserve a break. So we're going to bring back a wonderful interview with John Surtees from podcast number 706.
Yeah, you know, this is one of the great legends of motorsports on both two and four wheels, the one and only John Surtees. This conversation took place at Monza House, which is his business address in Edenbridge, Surrey. As always, first-class hybrid and Lexus luxury transportation provided by European Support Vehicle Number 1, courtesy of Mr. Peter Brazier. Our meeting with Mr. Surtees was scheduled for 30 minutes, but when boys are talking motor racing and the cars are turning right and left, cars and bikes are turning right and left, we go the full distance sometimes. We are really very fortunate to have an hour-long conversation with John Surtees. Today we will play part one, and part two will be on the Austin Grand Prix podcast. Many thanks to John and his staff for making this possible, and many thanks again to Mr. Brazier. Without his assistance, such con was impossible. So please enjoy.
When we talk about your great career, both on two and four wheels, what's your take on today's MotoGP and Formula One in terms of riders and racers and what I would call too much technology? You like that?
When you speak to a older person, that person has to be very careful to not be too biased in the way it was. I think that you cannot stop technology, and in some cases you don't want to. At times I'm not certain that technology makes a better product, end product. Like, for instance, in some cases, in racing, particularly in motorsport. But I prefer to sort of look upon it as two different eras. I would have hated to have missed the period I was in, which was so personal, and so personal relative to the equipment, where you were not sort of removed by a lot of technology. You were the technology. In fact, you were the computer. You were having to be the only person who relayed to anybody what was happening in the car or on the motorcycle, except for the stopwatch and a few little things like that, but there was no other data. So that was fascinating. Of course, lots of things. Safety was not of the high level it is today. And if I could switch the clock back from a point of view of years of age, I would no doubt still want to be involved today, despite all the changes which have come about. So I'd like to have the best of both worlds, the time to have sat in, because at times we paint very rosy pictures of how it was in the past. But some of the cars we drove were not very good. I mean, some of them were, pretty awful at times. And there was quite a large differential between different marques. If anything, now at the top end of the racing, in Formula One, they are a little more even. I know Mercedes has been very dominant, but you had the same before. You know, when, for instance, the Lotus and Cosworth relationship made a very dominant partnership. And so that, you've seen it all before, and I think that we have to sort of accept things as they are and say, right, yes, there are some good things, the circuits. I think the variety of circuits that we used to have was so much better. Nowadays, it's been fashioned to be very suitable for TV and for things like this, whereas we had more natural circuits in our time. And I would hate not to have driven on the old Nürburgring or the old Spa circuit, because they in particular were two circuits that I thought were very, very special. And it's now a different scene. But also, one thing I would miss if I was racing today is the fact that a car was built and you used to go out and do all the testing on it. You did all the testing and evaluation, and you were the test driver, and you did all the testing on it, and you developed it along. Whereas, of course, today, there is no testing to speak of. Just two or three tests at the beginning of the year. That is all stopped. So that relationship is something which I would miss. But just the same, for people like Sebastian Vettel, who is a great enthusiast, and had some difficulty transferring to the new formula, but for him, it's still special, the same as it is for these other people who are at the top, the Jensen Buttons and such like, and Alonso's and Hamilton's, and etc.
Now, you mentioned Spa and the old Nürburgring. You won a Formula One race at the ring. Which one was more of fun as a driver to drive, the Spa circuit or Nürburgring?
Oh, both different. Both very different, in that the Nürburgring was, of course, a circuit where I liked it in particular, because if you had a car, which in Italian you say it was simpatico.
Yeah.
A car which was which you were sort of there and but perhaps a little down on power or something. At the Nürburgring you could make the time up. You could make the time up and get a lot of satisfaction from it. And a variety of corners and everything else. All right, you didn't have guardrails and things like that, thank goodness. You only had hedges as a safety medium. But the ring had a very special character. When you went there, you felt you went back in time, because it all sort of was very much seeped in the history of what had happened with the Silver Arrows and everything else before the war. And going on the circuit allowed you as a driver to do a special job. Spa, for different reasons, because Spa, the very nature of it and the speed of it was one which, again, because Nürburgring was not the ultimate speed like you saw at Spa. At Spa, you had these long corners like Bourneville, which took place before the Masterstroke, where, you know, if you went through there, and you came through and you were perhaps 100 or 200 more revs as you came out of that corner, that would be multiplied so much and give you such an advantage down the straight. So that again was a different challenge, but still a very special challenge.
Yeah. Now, one of your great Grand Prix wins, actually one of the most exciting finishes, was at Monza, when you won for Honda. What I want to know
Well, Monza again has a circuit, has a corner a little like that, which used to be the Grandi Curva. Mm-hmm. The Grandi Curva was again one of those sort of corners where it could be a bit daunting, but if you did a 10-tenths job through it, mm-hmm. and really got it right, your speed down to Lesmos gave you a good advantage.
Now, when you won, I believe it was 68 with Honda, what I want to know is your thoughts about going into Parabolica, and what did Jack Brabham say to you after the race, if anything?
Jack was a great competitor. Jack was a great competitor. He was someone who you never quite knew what he would do if he was behind you, because Jack was quite unconventional at times. He'd grown up on the sort of dirt tracks and things like this, and so he didn't mind whether he used the circuit or he used the off-circuit to pass you at times.
Yeah.
But no, that was something where we had two cars which had totally different characteristics. The Brabham was light and had extremely good speed up to a given speed, whereas the Honda was heavy, and on a circuit without chicanes like Monza, once it got underway, the engine would perform well. It would, once you got over that, dragging that weight forward, it would go into top speed. I had a bit more top speed than Jack, but Jack got his speed a lot faster than me. So what happened was that Jack had been able to sort of pick me up and pass me, but on the lap before, I had seen where someone coming along the main straight there had obviously had an engine problem, mm-hmm. because the oil was all on, and there was all oil going into the corner, and they'd come out with their cement, mm-hmm. etc., all onto that. So I saw that, and the first thing to do is to stay away from it. And so I'm coming around, and I'd seen Jack, because he hadn't passed me there, I'd seen Jack there, and I knew very well that Jack would sort of do anything. So I was watching, and I managed to go through the Lesmos pretty good and everything else. So he wasn't that close to be able to get out of my slipstream early enough to be able to go by. And so I thought, all right, well, what am I going to do? My normal line would have been to take the inside and block him out.
Mm-hmm.
But that I thought, not particularly with my heavier car and everything else, I thought, no, that's not going to happen. So I thought, no, I'm going to take a chance. I'm going to go down on the conventional line, out of the sawdust, out of the sand, or cement, I should say, and leave it breaking to the latest I can, which will mean I will go into the corner a little deeper, and see. And luckily, Jack was true to nature. He was, he followed his normal instincts and said, I can't resist this, and he pulled out the slipstream and went there, and I thought, ah, that's it, and he came by and slipped up, and as he slipped, he went straight on. I went through the inside. And it's one time in my life that I did deliberately let my engine over rev.
Oh.
because the fact remains is I knew very well that if I actually did that gear change, because that first part of the circuit, he was that much faster, I had to rely upon getting to that start line, which was, you know, obviously on the first part of the circuit, as quick as possible. So I took the tightest lane, I came up quite close to the pits, and I also let it stay in the same gear without changing, into, it would have been, a fourth gear by then, so I left it sort of in third, right up to the start line.
Great finish, did he say anything to you after the race?
Great finish? No. I think he was just so totally and utterly upset. But later on, he sort of in his own way, he cracked an odd remark.
Yeah. And same season, there was this tragic race in France, and you refused to drive the air-cool Honda, which led to Joe Schlesinger.
When I left Ferrari, which was a great mistake for both of us, as the old man admitted some years later, and we should have found another way. In a way, I went along and I nearly got the championship with the Maserati. But then Honda came to me and said, we have a sort of 5-year program, but only if you come. We won't continue racing unless you join us. Well, I thought of all their successes in motorcycling and things, so I said, all right, but I think, well, we've got some years to try and sort this out, because the car they had built was very heavy and not as competitive a car in comparison to the one they'd built before, which was the 1.5 litre. The 1.5 litre was a different design team, and that was a better car competitive wise in its class. But a 3-litre car had some rather ancient features about it. So I went there and I tested and evaluated and tried to do some things. And as we spoke just now, we had the situation where I managed to persuade Mr. Nakamura to go back to speak to Mr. Honda and get permission to do a joint program with Lola Cars for the car that I won at Monza with, which was that one with which, and the reason we were able to do it so quickly was that I had done all the test work for George Bignotti,
mm-hmm.
The American,
yeah, very
rather famous indie,
yeah.
Tuner and preparer. And George had asked me to drive for him as such, and I'd asked Ferrari about that, if I could. Asked me to drive for him in the Indy race. But they wanted me to test out the new Lola. So I went to America, and I did the testing with the new Lola, and then I came back. Well, of course, I had my accident in Mossport with the Lola sports car,
mm-hmm.
when the suspension broke, and I had to lie in the hospital, give my opinion as to who should drive the car. And so I said, Graham Hill. And of course, Graham Hill won the race with it,
yeah.
that car. But knowing that chassis, I suggested that that chassis would be a very good possibility for fitting the V12 engine into, and that we could save perhaps 70 pounds, which is an enormous amount of weight.
Sure.
And that's what happened. That's what happened. Japan and Slough, which is where Lola cars were, came together. And it merged the two together, and we made the car in record time, and went to Monza and won.
And that's the car they call it, the press calls it Hondola.
Hondola, they called it the Hondola.
Yeah. Okay,
but
now...
But then, the program was still to make a new V12, a lightweight one, because we had all the possibilities, and the lightweight one was to be there. We did a new car we did an improved car for 68 with the old V12 slightly somewhat modified, torsion bar valve springs and things like this. And Mr. Kume, who became president, he had worked on this, and they improved the engine, and we built another chassis for it, again, this time again in England. And the car was, in fact, good enough to have won the championship. We could have won the championship with it, unless... But we had a lot of stupid problems, which were partly due to Honda policy of changing people. And so you tended to have people come in who were inexperienced, and inexperienced people make mistakes. And so we had a little bit of problems there. But we were waiting all the time, thinking, okay, if we can be very competitive with this, if we have a car which is £100 perhaps lighter than everything else, we're going to be very easy. But the program got stopped. And instead... because of the commercial situation in Japan, where they wanted to introduce a new range of like economy cars,
mm-hmm.
The oil and air-cooled engine, which was something which was being promoted in the factory, as being a very good idea, was suddenly introduced into an engine for Formula One. And it suddenly appeared. I didn't know anything about it. No one said a word. It suddenly appeared because a separate team had done it.
Mm-hmm.
Had to test it. So I tested it two or three times. Probably, if one had taken it and looked at it carefully from a testing and said, right, well, if we made this more conventional... Now, if we made this water-cooled, etc., the car could have had some potential. But as it was, in the times I ran it, it was impossible to do more than just a few laps without some problem with the systems. So we said, no, it can't race. We have to continue.
Okay, now your racing start was very interesting. You were 14 years old, I understand, and competing with your dad in the sidecar of his Vincent bike. A question I have, racing was so dangerous, as you mentioned, in those days. Was your mom supportive of your racing efforts when you were a teenager?
Oh, yes, yes. Mum, when my father had started to and taken up racing, with a motorcycle and sidecar. It was about the same time, it was a time when my mother actually acted as passenger for him.
Yeah.
Yeah, acted as passenger for him. And she had no motoring background at all. And before that, my father's... only connection really with motoring was driving in the army, because he ran away from a home and volunteered for a driving in France in the First World War. And so he was driving there, and was driving an ambulance. And then after a war, he was driving a bus. So that was his only experience, but he got very keen on motorcycles. And so he started motorcycle racing and raced up until the war. He was British champion when war broke out. And then he was asked to volunteer, because he was overage, volunteer for the to go back in the military to train riders and also organise a workshop at a place here in England called Catterick in Yorkshire. And so that's where he was. When war finished, he started, he came back and started his business, and that's when I first started remembering about being involved in motorcycles.
Interesting. Now, your first motorbike victory came in your, if I have this right, third ever race in South Wales. This had a profound effect on your racing life.
I had my road racing career started at Brands Hatch. The very first tarmac race as Brands Hatch. And that was with a 250 Triumph, a Tiger 70, that I'd modified. Dad had given it to me, and so I went and drilled lots of holes to lighten it, and I modified the ports and things like this, thinking I knew how to do this. And it went quite well, but I actually took the lead in that first race, in that first final, but I took the lead sitting on my backside because it had started to rain and I slid past the person who was in front. But after that, I did one too, and then I went to Silverstone with it. And at Silverstone, the connecting rod broke, and again I went on the ground and down the road. And that coincided with my father saying I ought to get some better qualification, and I so he arranged for me to have an apprenticeship at a Vincent company, who were quite specialist, quite special motorcycles, and he was the agent for these. And so I went to Vincent. When he was down there, and we were down there, we saw this bike lying in a corner, and Mr. Vincent said it might be an idea for me, and so he acquired that from Vincent, and I put it together, and that's the bike which I won my first race with.
Now, did you enjoy working on your bikes yourself in those days?
That was my first love.
Oh, really?
Yeah, my first love was, frankly, just working on the mechanics of it. I didn't think about competing. Although I was a sort of very interested in sports, I loved working on things, and I worked on bicycles quite a lot. Modifying them and doing things. And then while my father had just before at the end of the war, he came home one day and he gave me two big boxes, and in these boxes was a Wallace Blackburn Speedway bike of 1932, I think it was. And he said, put it together and you can ride it. And so that, I suppose, was that was in fact the first bike I ever rode.
Now, in 1955, at the age of 21, you had an unbelievable season, winning 70 races from 86 starts.
Now, these 78, yeah, 78.
And these numbers are staggering. Was this all pure natural racing talent you had, or was this a lot of preparation and testing involved also?
Well, I did. No, I didn't have time for testing and things. One, we didn't have, I wouldn't have had the money to do the testing on the tracks. And two, and that time I got a 250 machine because I had started with a Vincent, and I sold the Vincent to buy a Norton, and with the Norton I started, and then I carried on my success, and earned a little money, and sort of got a second Norton, and then NSU asked me if I would like to have a Sportmax, a 250, so I had a 250 to use. So I was doing 250, 350 and 500 races all in the same weekend, and working during the week. And at the weekend, my mother would probably drive the truck, and I would catch up my sleep and sleep in the back, and we'd go off to our race meetings, like in Wales, or this. And sometimes we would do, if it was a bank holiday, we would do a race meeting, say, at Brands Hatch on Friday. We would do another race meeting on the Saturday, somewhere else. Another one on Saturday, another one on Monday. So we do sort of like four race meetings.
So you've had the good life for a long, long time.
Same the fact is, in 55, and also I was racing in 55 for the Works Norton team. So in between that, I was with people like Joe Craig, who had been at the helm of the Norton team, very famous team for so many years. So, tremendous amount of experience in a relatively short while.
Now, your move into motor racing was made possible due to contractual obligation placed on you by Count Agusta. Now, tell us a little bit about that background, where they did not want you to race other bikes.
Well, when I raced for Agusta, I also kept my own Norton machines, and at the beginning of the year and end of the year, I would finish my world championship year, and then I would come along and I would go to, say, Scarborough, Aintree, Silverstone, and ride my own machines. And the Italian newspapers said, Surtees doesn't need an MV Agusta to win. And Count Agusta got upset. He said, no, non è possibile. It's not... and so, it's not... Well, the year before, and we're talking... we're talking 58, end of 58. I had been with Mike Hawthorne, who had just won the World Championship with Ferrari. Also, I was with Tony Vanderbilt, who had won the World Championship with Vanwall, the constructors. And with Reg Parnell, who was team manager of Aston Martin. And that was there. Just after that meeting, and I said, no, I'm not interested in driving a car. I'm too concentrated on my motorcycling. When Mike had asked me, Rich Parnell invited me to test the Aston Martin, and I tested the Aston Martin and enjoyed it, and he offered me a contract, and I said no. Tony Vanderbilt heard that I tested the Aston Martin, so he said, you must test the Vanwall. And so I tested the Vanwall, and he offered me a contract. He said, you start race with me, Formula One. I said, you're not racing, you've retired. But I'll start again. It's Tony Vanderbilt. So I said, no, I'm motorcycling. But when I thought of that, when Agusta said this, I thought, well, isn't it? I quite enjoyed my time when I tried the four wheels. I'd buy a car. So I went to buy a Cooper Formula 2 car. But when I was there, he asked me to introduce someone to me. And that person introduced himself as Ken Till. Wow. And told me that he had entered me for the March race at Goodwood, that he'd spoken and he'd got me a license, and that I should be there because they weren't going to have the car ready before to test it. But if I turn up on that day, I can drive a car. So I went there for the first day to a race meeting, and I saw a race meeting for the first time in car racing from a cockpit. I actually put it on pole.
Wow.
But had made a mistake in the race and went passing someone and went off onto the grass. But I came back and Jimmy Clark in the Lotus beat me. But after another race in that car and a race in my own car, two races in my own car, Colin Chapman rang me up and said, Colin Chapman came up to see me at Aintree, because I'd just been first British car there, and said, "It's Formula One, John." So I said, "Well, I'm a motorcycle." He said, "Oh, come and test." So I tested Formula One. He said, "I want you to drive for me." Okay? I said, "Well, I can't. I'm a motorcycle." "Well, drive for me when you're not motorcycling." So that's what I did. When I wasn't motorcycling, I went along and I did three or Grand Prix, I think. It was, first one was Monaco, the gearbox failed. I think the second one,
Portugal, I believe.
The second one was probably Portugal, yeah. And I put it on pole, and I was leading the race, and only for silly circumstances lost me the race, because I was about 26 seconds in the lead. But I came back to England, and I came second. So that was a start.
You know, some years ago I was talking to Jean-Pierre Bertoaz, who raced motorcycles before.
Huh?
Jean-Pierre Bertoaz, the
yes.
French driver. He raced motorcycles for many
That's
years.
Right.
And I asked him, what are the racing techniques which are different in two wheels to four wheels, and how big was the adjustment for him? And he said it's exactly the same. He had no problem. You were quick, whether you were driving two wheels or four wheels or a Formula One car first time. Did you feel any major changes in terms of your driving techniques or racing techniques?
I had no problem in the speed. I was, as I say, I was as quick as anybody from the start. But I didn't have the experience to back up that speed. And that's what, whereas on the motorcycle, you would start and you would have the experience of people around you. You would know them and you would know. You would have experience of the other riders, so that you know which ones you trust, which ones you don't trust, etc. And that's always important in a race. And all of that you have to learn. So the fact is, what happens, the difference is, that when you start the other one, although you are quite capable, you are under more nervous tension, because of all the facts you don't know, and that means that you have to do the learning curve in order to get that inner relaxation which comes with a little experience. The inner relaxation to where you're all very calm and collected, as against you're having to concentrate and be more stressful at the very beginning.
And you mentioned Colin Chapman. What was it like to work with him? And also there was a situation developing between Chapman and Ines Ireland, and Jim Clark was also involved in that.
No, well, Jim Clark wasn't involved in it at all, really, apart from the fact that I chose Jim to be my teammate, because he'd been at Lotus before me, I was a new boy, but Colin asked me for 1961 to be his team leader. And then that's when the problem with Ines Ireland started. And but you know, Jimmy as such, you know, wasn't involved at all, because he was there and I'd said that, and it was just a case of when it all blew up, and I was probably a little too prompt. I probably felt a little too much, in a way, I suppose, some anger over the fact that a number of the racing fraternity hadn't liked very much my coming in and being so quick, so early, and getting these opportunities. And some of these included some journalists, and who had made it very uncomfortable, some of the things. And so so I just walked away from it, whereas really, I should have been a little more, like I approached my racing, a little less emotional. And it was a case of, I felt a little let down and it was all offered around, and I found out these other things about other contracts and things. No, because I liked Colin. I liked Colin, and we got on very well, the working, and we understood each other, and I think he did appreciate it, because he said, without any experience, come along and lead the team.
And what was your working relationship and friendship off the track with Jim Clark?
Jim, fine. I mean, when I got married for the first time, Jim, I said, it's the only time in my life I will consider him as best man. because I had him along at my wedding. Yeah.
That's good. Now, Colin Chapman, obviously...
Because it had been Jim who had, in a way, introduced that girl to me.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
And Colin Chapman, along with Enzo Ferrari, two of the greatest names in the history of motor racing. What did you find? You worked with both of them in terms of where they were similar and where they were different in their approach
to racing.
Oh, they're
very different. They're very different. In that Colin Chapman, of course, had been more of a driver than Enzo had, and also was more technical. But from a point of view, probably of their, where they probably had a similarity was their aspirations for their mark. Colin lived for Lotus, whereas Enzo lived for Ferrari. That part of it, same. Down at the bottom of the car side of it, the technical side and also the driving side, Colin would have been stronger with. But Enzo sort of was also obviously a very special look. What would a Grand Prix be like today without a Ferrari?
Oh yeah, absolutely. Now, your friend Mr. Dan Gurney.
Dan, yes.
Yeah, he's a great
great guy.
Yeah, I was talking to him some years ago, and he drove for Enzo also, and I asked him about the Ferrari politics, and he said it did not affected him, or he did not feel much of it when he was driving for Ferrari. Now, in your case, you had some issue with the team manager, Eugenio Dragoni. What happened there?
Dan was driving in a slightly different period, of course. You've got to remember that when Dan drove there, Enzo Ferrari, it was all sort of part of the old establishment. He went to race meetings as such, the same as his wife did, and he had a closer involvement. By the time I went there, with his son having died, etc., Enzo was no longer going to any races except practice at Monza. So, whereas before, he was first hand there and seeing for himself. He was only getting it second hand because you didn't have a lot of television or media except radio and such like. So you're relying on hearsay and what a journalist wrote. You also didn't have a situation where you had all the politics going on with Ford and Ferrari. And Ford and Ferrari and Fiat, with Ferrari in the middle. So they were all the factors which led to my divorce and certain parties. It was something which the old man admitted was wrong, and which I also realised is wrong. And I think that rather like that time, perhaps, with Colin, that time with Ferrari is something where I should have found a different way of dealing with the situation which came up. Because it was wrong for him and wrong for me that we parted. Because we had the opportunity of at least two championships together, more. Because certainly we had the championship to be able to be won in 66, and certainly with the material we had, we could have won it in 67.
Now, another great character who worked for Ferrari was Mr. Carlo Chitti. Did you spend time working with him, or was he before your time?
Unfortunately.
You did?
I only worked with him once, for a short while. And that was when he was with Alfa Romeo.
Okay.
After I left Ferrari. The first time I didn't go to Ferrari, when they first asked me, was after I met Carlo Chitti for the first time, and he said about all the drivers they had and all the things they were going to do. And I thought, if you're going to have got all these drivers, you don't need me. So I didn't accept. After I left Ferrari, he asked me to come along and drive his sports car for him. So I carried out a test for him at the Alfa track, and I carried out some setting changes, etc., which made it much nicer for me to drive it, and quicker. We went to Sebring to race, and I went out in practice, and I thought, this car doesn't feel the same. And I came back in, and I thought, oh, well, it's the same. But one of the mechanics said to me, no, Engineer Keaty told us to put it back to original. So in his own way, he was just testing me out.
Ah.
So I told him, forget it, and I left the track. I didn't drive. So that's my experience with Mr. Chitti.
Okay.
He was there. But still, that was an unfortunate experience.
Now, you mentioned Sebring, a fantastic facility in the U.S. Is this photo from, what's in the other room? Is that a picture of Can-Am? Was that from Riverside?
Yes.
How much did you like American racing scene?
It's a good scene. I like the scene there. It's some good tracks. I understand that Riverside is now a housing estate.
Shopping mall.
Yeah, shopping mall and things. That all had its real characters. It's quite different, with the sand blowing across the track and all those things. But good tracks in America. And the scene was... what was also good. Can-Am was something which I found quite enjoyable. We did it with a very sort of personal way. It was just basically the van driver was also the chief mechanic and myself, and we went and raced in Can-Am, and local enthusiasts who we had met who came along and helped us.
And you won the championship, right?
And we won the championship with that. Yes.
Beautiful.
Yeah.
Okay, now earlier you mentioned...
And it was nice working with a nice little team at a firm called Traco. Who prepared the engines, which was a Chevy, etc. It's fine.
Now, earlier in our conversation, you mentioned if you could go back in time, and this is my favorite question to you. If you could go back in time and do a championship-winning season all over again, be it motorcycling or Formula One, which season was your favorite, or that you're most proud of, your accomplishments?
Would it either be motorcycling or cars?
Whichever you think was the biggest satisfaction challenge for you that you're most proud of.
I would choose 2 years.
Okay, we'll give you 2 years.
I would do 2 years. Well, on bikes, I would choose 57, having won my first championship.
Mm-hmm.
I would have loved to have gone along and just followed it up with a second one, but they made some bad mistakes at Augusta, and I'd like to right those mistakes, because they learned them afterwards and everything else. Also, the events of 1966, obviously I'd like to change.
Okay,
the number
great.
Of things which happened, we had so many stupid things. Apart from the Ferrari divorce, there was also some absolutely stupid things that lost me Grand Prix and lost me the championship. And I'd just like to put it right.
Put it right. A minute again. In terms of people you have raced against, you've raced, you know, against great legends both on two wheels and four wheels. Let me put it this way. If you owned a motorcycle team, in the time you raced motorcycles, and you had to pick up two drivers as your team drivers, who would they be? And same thing for Formula One, from your Formula One days.
Well, if I go back into motorcycling, of course, you've got to think of who the world champion was at the time. Okay. And who I was first able to beat with my Nortons, in fact, and that was Jeff Duke. Yeah. Jeff Duke was someone who was, you know, very special in motor racing. But there was a number of people who were there. You had, you know, both in the motorcycling, both British and Italian and German, in that I had people like Bob McIntyre, who was particularly special in the Isle of Man. There's Walter Zeller, the German driver on BMW, rider on BMWs, and John Hartle, who was in fact for a while a teammate of mine, etc. He was very special. There's a whole bunch of them who were good and good competitors and people doing it for the right reasons. The same things in a car racing. In my car racing, when I sort of first entered it, of course it was Jimmy who was there, and Jack, I've already mentioned. Jack was a great guy from the point of view of he achieved something which I wasn't able to achieve, which is he won a championship also in his own car. But he's a real trier. Jack would never gave up trying. Dan Gurney, probably with his ability, probably deserved some more success as such. You also got sort of Graham Hill, who was a great trier, a great person who always very steady and everything. Not the fastest of drivers out, but the fact is just the same, always someone who you'd be sure would put up a good race. So there's a number of them. But as usual, you normally have a little group of 3-4 people there, and then a group of them all just below.
Yeah. Now, you had your team in Formula One. How challenging was being a team owner in Formula One? Very different than today, but still, I'm sure, quite a lot of work involved there.
Well, in a way, that's a bit of a sad time of my life, because we started, and we started on the basis of a mistake. I didn't intend to go into car racing, and possibly for John Surtees Limited, for John Surtees myself, driver, perhaps I should have just concentrated on making sure I sat my backside in the best possible car. But over some problems, I ended up with a Formula 5000 project. I had bought a 5000 project for another person who had asked me to do it for them, and I'd done it, and then they didn't proceed. So I was left holding this project of a Formula 5000 car. So we went along, we tested it and developed it, and that became the Surtees TS5, which raced in America. Sam Posey's and these people raced those. And I think we won the British Championship. It was very good. Then I had a year where I had two bad experiences. I made two of the worst mistakes that I'd done by the two teams I signed for in 1959. And at the end of that one, I said, no, I must look after myself. I'll do something. So having had the 5000 team, I had a team who was making these, in a place we had in Slough, I decided to build a Formula One. So I built a Formula One in 1970, which was ready for the British Grand Prix. There's a possibility of us getting fourth place in that first race with it, but the big ends went. We had made a mistake on the oil tank. But from then onwards, it ended up with too much work for me as a driver and as a manager and a this and a that and everything else. So my driving was reducing. So I did a testing of the cars, but I didn't do too much racing. But our cars were capable of, and of putting up lap records in Grand Prix and of being on the podium. But we unfortunately ended up getting involved. The first time we thought we had a big sponsor, we got involved with a company who ended up not paying us. And that, we fought that over a period of about 3 years or so. But with legal and everything else costs, we had to stop and we had to accept our costs. But nothing else. And I, by that time, it had made me ill. So I just had to stop the team. And that was the end of it.
Now, you mentioned earlier...
Now those cars only live. The cars which we still have, which are there, which is, you know, we won the European Championship with a Formula 2 car. So we have one of those, which I also won the Japanese Grand Prix with. But, and we have Tier 7, the first one we made. And we have some Tier 14s, which was the ones like... Mike Howard, etc., drove. And those we make work for the foundation.
How was Mike Howard in cars?
Oh, Mike Howard was good. Mike Howard was good. We saw Mike, he was having trouble with the cars, and we thought, well, it needs a motorcyclist to understand a motorcyclist, because Mike didn't pretend to have any sort of technical involvements or abilities. He just loved riding, driving, and doing all sorts of things. And so we came together, and he's a good, honest lad who always tried, and you could rely on.
Now, you mentioned earlier about the Henry Surtees Foundation. Will you please tell us a little bit about it and all the good work you are doing?
Well, foundation is one of those things, of course, which I wish I'd never seen because of the circumstances. But Henry, my son, who started karting at 8 years of age, did karts, into cars at 15, quite a successful time, Formula BMW, did a little bit of Formula Renault. And then we put him into Formula 2. And at a race, a series of circumstances all added up to the fact that he was in this race, and someone who was in front of him crashed, and the wheel came off, and... bounced over and hit him and killed him, and that was it. And so you know, that was something which I suppose we'll never get over.
Yeah, but your foundation you have set up with your wife, and you folks are doing a great job.
Well,
in his memory, tell us a little bit about the work of the foundation, please.
I thought of just walking away from motorsport entirely, but on the day of the foundation, the day of the service for him, we asked for donations instead of flowers for a charity that we knew in Tunbridge Wells relative to head injuries, and we got £34,000 given. And I thought, those people are doing this, I'll continue to work with Henry, and we'll form the foundation. So we form the foundation, and that's what we do. We work to create, and the people who work for me in my normal business all have to spend a bit of time on the foundation, so that we keep costs to the very minimum. And we've been involved in projects which largely are all there to save time, projects which are there to save time relative to injury and ill health. And so we've worked with air ambulance and some hospitals, all with equipment. We don't get involved in any expenses to anyone. We only get involved in equipment. We get involved in equipment for introducing blood transfusions and other things which save time. And we also have a project, which is why, perhaps I'm so busy as well at the moment, I went along and bought the kart circuit where Henry first drove a kart. And I hope to create a learning centre there to get youngsters from a community into some form of training, so that they can have a career in engineering, or perhaps even within the motorsport industry. Not to make drivers, but to to give them a career based upon them getting emotionally involved. Just the same as I got emotionally involved when I had those spanners given me, mm-hmm. and I worked on that bike. Sure. I think the same can apply, and I saw what it did with Henry. I think the same can apply to other youngsters in this community. And these days, I think it's vitally important that we get away from where people live entirely by the screen, and they also go along and put head and hands working in cooperation together their careers.
You know, it's very important. And now in today's corporate culture of motorsports, which is so different from, you know, even 30 years ago, do you think we can have a racer down the road who can do a John Surtees and win a championship in MotoGP and Formula One?
Maybe. Who knows? Who knows? But only one thing's certain, and that is they can't be first.
Yeah, I'm so proud that I'm here talking to the first.
That's only one thing certain, yeah.
Yeah. You know, Britain has produced more world champion than any other nation, and you're involved with Racing Steps Foundation. Why is it that Britain has produced so many world champions? Is it because most of the teams are based here, or the Brits are just better drivers?
I think it's part of the fact that traditionally, of course, a lot has happened here. You know, motorsport going back has had, and since I suppose Tony Vandervelde went along and created that Van Wall car, which was followed by Lotus and Cooper, and the fact that the thing what started the motorsport industry at a higher level in this country, I believe, was the fact of Coventry Climax. Coventry Climax came along and produced an engine which was made available. That was followed up by Ford and the production of the Cosworth. And so on the basis of those two units, a whole industry was developed, which was very competitive, and it's just spread from there. And so it's all sort of ingrained in it. And going back into motorcycling, of course, you had this tremendous industry in this country. You had the Nortons, the AGSs, the Triumphs, the BSAs, all these people, Vincents. Sadly, you know, we only have one live one, really, which is Triumph now. But that was very much there, and I think that together with the sort of mentality as such all fits. And of course, the other thing which was really good was that we had quite a small island, but we had a lot of race circuits.
Oh yeah.
We had a lot of race circuits, lots of little race circuits here, there and everywhere. So there was an opportunity for people in small distances to be able to do a lot of racing on a lot of varied circuits. And that's very important. Whereas when you go to the States, for instance, the distances one has to travel. Perhaps you just race here at Bridgehampton on the old days, yeah. You know, but then you have to travel a long way to go somewhere else.
Yeah, very true. Okay, sir, I'm very thankful for your time. It's very nice to see you. Finally, would you have a message to our listeners? We have a global listener base, quite a few in the UK. The gentleman is one of them. Would you like to say something to our listeners?
Well, the big thing is about life is that if one can go along and actually be able to go through life in doing something which largely you can be 100% involved in and love, then you're very privileged. So from that point of view, I feel that, you know, despite the hard days when it sort of started, which I didn't appreciate, it was just taken for natural. Back there with Mum and Dad and the sacrifices they made to get me started and etc. I've been, you know, very privileged to go through that situation. Made mistakes, etc. But I would just sort of like to say to them, please continue to enjoy your motorsport and to support it.
Thank you so much, and we are greatly honored to meet you.
Thank you, Nasser. John Surtees, thanks again for joining F1Weekly.com. I want to thank everyone who listens. Good night.
Thank you.